south old went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plowing through the ragged sky, and up a cloudy draw.
This is Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona with Western Short Stories. Today we'll be reading a couple more stories from Talking Leaves, Contemporary Native American Short Stories. These were introduced and edited by Craig Leslie, and the associate editor is Catherine Stavrakis. This volume was published in 1991 by Delta Trade Press in New York City. And I remind you that our stories are sometimes edited slightly for recording. Our first tale is entitled China Brown by Gerald Weisnor. China Brown waited with the privileged cadre in the new railroad station lounge. She trimmed her nails and looked over pictures in a news magazine. She would not touch her bare arms or neck to the couch because the leather was stained and smelled of garlic sweat. Two men in uniform smoked and whispered at the counter near the entrance to the lounge. A man in a thin white shirt wheezed in a corner chair. His stout arms surrounded a plastic briefcase with a broken zipper. Enormous fans whirred near the door to the latrine and circulated the noisome stench of urine. China smiled as she read the faded broadsides on the wall over the counter. Travel legends overrun with advertisements and cautions. China, a treasure in the heart. See Tibet with two big eyes. Make wind on a phoenix bicycle. Chemicals not to travel the trains. No spit the floor. Monkey King opera. No spit the street. Outside, in the main section of the train station, tired women hunkered over their children and cloth bundles. The men smoked and watched foreigners. Some families, in spite of the heat, cooked on charcoal braziers. Elders heated water for tea. The pollution beclouded the patriotic portraits high on the walls in the station. An American couple, a mock blonde and her bearded husband, rushed into the lounge and collapsed, breathless, on the leather couch. She counted their parcels and suitcases, retied a carton wrapped with newspaper, and then she fanned her neck and measured the other people in the lounge. The two men in uniform moved closer to read the headlines on her carton. The folded pictures of four men convicted of rape and sentenced to death. "Angel and me are teachers here. This is our second year," said the bearded man in a loud voice. "We thought it might be easier the second time around with some experience. But maybe not. Who are you?" "China Brown." "Angel, this is China Brown," he said, and dried his beard with a hand towel. "Well then, you must be part Chinese." "Native American," she said with a smile, and waited for the characteristic response. The racial catechism, questions about reservations, religion, language, and tribal radicals in prison. "Aren't we all? Native American Indian." "Like I said, aren't we all?" said Angel. "Make up your mind," he said. "China, like made in China?" asked Angel. When she leaned forward, her white thighs squeaked on the dark leather. "Where did you ever get a name like that?" "From my father," whispered China. "Cinch is my nickname," he announced. "China is mine." "My father said making me was a cinch, the easiest thing he ever did that ended up paid to travel and talk in a classroom," boasted Cinch. "China comes to China," mused Angel. "Where are you going in this awful, awful heat?" She mopped her short hair and withered neck with a towel. Rouge and other cosmetic hues were smeared on her cheeks. China was prepared to respond when a woman in a big blue uniform propped open the double doors and announced the departure of the train to Tianjin. China nodded to Angel and then shouldered her overnight pack. Children chirred in the wide corridor of the station. Women washed their babies on the aisle, and toddlers pissed on the terrazzo. Cinch and Angel plodded through the crowd with their parcels. "China, you're my kind of woman." "How's that?" "You travel light." Cinch carried 3 suitcases in a backpack. "There are no porters here. Not since the revolution, you can be sure." "Liberation here, burden there," mocked China. "Where's your luggage?" asked Angel.
"Beijing Hotel."
"So you've been here how long?"
"3 days, long enough to catch my breath."
"Here, carry this then. You need something in your hands to be with us."
Angel handed her the carton wrapped with newspaper, which was much heavier than the suitcases. The coarse rope cut into her fingers. China pressed through the narrow turnstile behind an old woman with bound feet. The woman was dressed in loose blue trousers, a black blouse, and a brown shroud on her shoulders. She wore a visor cap with a red ceramic star on the front, cocked back on her head like a soldier. China was pushed down the stairs, butted with baskets and hard bundles. She slowed the press from behind so the old woman could hobble at her own speed down to the platform. There, when the woman stopped near the tracks in a patch of light and held a rail ticket close to one eye, China moved closer to her side, turned, and smiled. The woman covered the ticket with both hands, as if her destination were a state secret, and stared at the nose of the foreigner. Then the old peasant woman lowered her head in silence. China bowed, bundled her hands between her breasts, and spoke in Chinese. "China Brown is my name," she said in measured tones. "I am an American." The old woman wobbled to the side on her golden lilies and dropped her cloth bundle. China reached down to retrieve the bundle, but the old woman shivered, waved her arms, and dropped her ticket. She moved over the ragged cloth, raised her head, and shouted, "Yang Yui Zi, Yang Yui Zi," which means foreign devil. China moved back when a crowd gathered around her on the platform. The woman shouted that the foreign devil had spied on her, tried to read her ticket and steal her clothes. The men smoked and watched the scene in silence. The women in the crowd repeated in whispers what the old woman had shouted.
"China, never mind. Mao's still on her mind," said Cinch. "There's nothing you can do or say. Best to count your change and move on with the other foreign devils."
"Love that star on her hat," said China. She brushed her hair back, smiled, and pretended not to be troubled by the occurrence. "We've been around a year and we still don't understand," said Angel. "So don't get your hopes up in 3 days. Best to ignore the old people unless they seek you out."
"Nothing comes of trying to help people here. They won't even help each other."
"Estranged and with no porters," muttered China.
"Right, that's the ticket," said Cinch.
He moved their suitcases to cover a particular crack on the platform. "There," he exclaimed,
"is where the soft seat coach will stop, right there on the crack, right on time."
The old woman hobbled down the platform to a place she knew that the hard seat coach would stop, crowded, unreserved, right on the mark. She waited with her head raised, her mouth puckered. China would overturn mistrust and suspicion on the baronage, back on the reservation, with tribal trickeries. However, she was a foreign devil cornered in a hardcore diorama with no natural cues to the humor in the nation. Men stared at her breasts, that was not new, and the children watched her shoes. The women whispered about the prominence of her nose, and the criminals pictured on the carton that she carried. The locomotive thundered into the station, and steam smothered the curious crowd on the platform. Cinch sat on the aisle, sipped green tea, and commented on each crossroad, hamlet, lime mine, and the new advertisement on the sides of buildings between Beijing and Tianjin. When the train arrived, he was on the platform in seconds. He maneuvered through the crowded station and onto the main street. Angel ran close behind and complained the whole distance. China, meanwhile, waited in the station to see the old peasant woman once more. She hobbled alongside a couple with an automatic washer and an enormous carton tied to a bicycle. The old woman waited at the curb outside the station for a few minutes. She raised her head several times and then hobbled across the wide street, oblivious to the trucks and buses. She paused on the other side, raised her head, and turned down to the river. The bank was stepped with rough concrete. Children swam into the black water from the last tier. Women spread their washed clothes on the concrete. The old woman inched down the bank, side to side on her narrow, bound feet. The tiers were crowded with people. Hundreds were at the waterline to cool their bodies on the breeze over the river. China leaned back on a tier high above the water and watched the children, the old woman, and the boats loaded with bales. She remembered the baronage, the cedar, and her grandmother, who lived in a wigwam near the river. China removed her shoes, spread her toes on the rough concrete, and prepared to meditate. However, when she drew the blue bandana from her shoulder pack, the old woman stumbled over a seam on the last tier and bounced into the water. The woman was desperate. She held her arms and shoulders above the water, but she was weak. Her hands trembled on the concrete. China was 13 tiers above the river. She waited for someone to help the old woman. There were people near her, but no one seemed to notice. Her bound lotus feet bobbed in the dark water, stunted creatures from the imperial past. China shouted and waved with her shoes to those below. When no one responded, she bounded down the tiers. She eased the old woman back from the water and rested her head on the shoulder pack. The woman shivered on the concrete. She moved to hide her feet and her cloth bundle under the shroud. The two women watched each other in silence. The one smiled, and then the other. China raised the wet shroud and spread it on the concrete tiers to dry. She unbound the old woman, loosened the swathes, uncovered her feet. China opened the tender, wizened toes like secrets and cleaned the pinched, ochreous nails. The lotus toes were more erotic than she had imagined, more beauteous than the pictures of bound feet she treasured as a child. She dried the turned toes with her blue bandana, the same cloth she drew between her own toes in meditation. The cicadas roared in the broad leaves, and boat whistles sounded on the river. Diesel engines bellowed over the bridge in the distance. China drowsed, and children dabbled in the water on the tier below her head. She dreamed that her grandfather floated past on a boat and told stories about the mixed-blood trickster who lived in a town clock. The trickster read the minds of those who looked to the tower for their time, and he set the hands back to calm the nerves. Luster Beau said that when the trickster moved the hands on the tower clock, the time in the whole town moved back. This, he mused, was the pleasure of a compassionate tribal trickster. China awakened when the boat passed and the stories ended. The old woman had bound her toes and waited with her cloth bundle at her side. China shouldered her pack, and the two women climbed the tiers together. China narrated the rise with the origin of her name and the baronage of her reservation. The old woman did not respond. She was out of breath and did not seem to hear the stories. China ushered the woman to a wooden bench that overlooked the river. There, beneath a tree, she shouted into a panic hole, and the old woman understood. She smiled, nodded, and bowed, and then she clapped her withered hands. China shouted a second time into the seared earth. "Yang Gui Zi," she whispered, and then laughed louder than she had shouted earlier on the platform. The old woman leaned over and presented a small herb box and her cloth cap to the foreign devil on the bench beside her. She polished the red star, bowed twice more, and hobbled down the road. China watched the old woman cross the bridge. She vanished in the crowd. Cinch was irritated that the time in his measured world had been disturbed by China. He marched to the back of the bench and shouted in her ear, "Where have you been? We've been looking all over the place for you. Now we're late." She was taken unawares and twitched with his voice. When she turned, he circled the bench. He pulled his beard as he marched. Then he stopped and waited for her response. 2 o'clock on my watch, she said. China had moved the hands back 1 hour. She leaned back on the bench and smiled at the tormented man. Were you in a hurry to get somewhere? Well, 2 o'clock, he muttered, and looked around for confirmation of the time. My watch is 10 minutes fast, then.
Where'd you get that hat? Asked Angel.
She complained about the heat from at least a block behind her husband. She'd brushed her cheeks with a second coat of cosmetics. Remember that old woman on the platform?
No, you ran her down and stole it, shouted Angel.
Good for you, shouted Cinch.
No, she gave it to me, said China.
Gave it to you? Never.
Yes, she gave it to me.
What for?
Well, she fell in the river, and I pulled her out when no one else would help, related China. We talked. She showed me her bound feet, and then she gave me the cap. Do you like the star?
Bullshit, snapped Cinch.
These people never help each other, harped Angel.
Come on, China. You either stole it or you found it on the bench, insisted Cinch. Anyway, you look like a typical Mao mocker in a cap like that, with a commie star, no less.
She gave me this little box of herbs, too, said China. She opened the round metal box and raised the thick brown flecks close to her nose. The cover was decorated with bound lilies and pale monarchial portraits.
What is it?
Some kind of herb, she said. China spread the contents on the palm of her hand. The old woman showed me how to sniff it, open the nostrils wide and inhale in short breaths, but the herb smells rather musty to me.
Those are not herbs, he shouted.
Cinch pinched his nose closed and moved back from the bench.
Keep that shit away from me.
Don't tell me.
What is it then? Asked Angel.
Scabs.
Sore scabs?
You have a sick sense of humor, said China.
They're diseased scabs.
Spare me, please.
No shit, China.
Cinch knows, believe me, pleaded Angel.
Rich Chinese picked smallpox wounds, he explained from the other side of the bench, and shared the scabs with relatives. Sort of a token inoculation, a smell for good health.
China returned the scabs to the metal box. Her nose creased and her muscles trembled. Nice box, she said, and pinched the cover closed. She placed the box on the bench and wiped her moist hands on her trousers.
Box? Box? Where's our box? Shouted Angel.
Shit, did you lose our juice extractor?
Was that a juicer?
What did you do with it?
Where is it?
Angel shouted and pranced on the hard earth behind the bench. She pounded her arms and her neck blushed with anger.
Forgive me. When I rushed down the steps to help the old woman, I left the box behind, explained China.
A juicer. No wonder it was so heavy.
Where'd you leave it?
Cinch, you told me that China is not a nation of thieves, chanted China. Unlike America, you said. People always return things here. So what's there to worry about?
Nice move. Now where did you leave the juicer?
Down 3 tiers, said China.
What time's it, Angel?
2:15, she answered. But I thought it was later than that. What was that big rush then?
Angel leaned back on the wooden bench and sighed.
Our marriage has been a timed event. We are ruled by the clock.
There, the box is down 1 tier, right where I left it, said China. More than a dozen men circled the carton with their hands behind their backs to read the news stories about the condemned criminals. What was in the carton did not seem to interest them.
Are you really an Indian? Asked Angel.
Not really, mocked China. You see, my grandfather was a nobleman.
He was the Baron of Petronia, and we inherited the baronage.
Really?
Yes, really.
The Chinese love titles. You got it made, China, she said.
Angel turned and watched her husband climb the stepped bank with the juice extractor.
Angel, please don't wrap our packages with newspapers next time, he said, winded.
Cinch unwrapped the carton.
These people seldom steal, but they read anything, even instructions.
In that case, said China, you should cover everything you own with newspapers. Consider it insurance, crowd protection of the contents.
China is a lord. Did you know that?
Of course, said Cinch.
Listen, how did you know that?
She travels lighter than the rest of us.
That's my Cinch, said Angel.
We got nothing to lose, so wrap the other packages with newspapers, but turn those capital punishment stories under this time.
Cinch leaned back on the bench. He wiped his head and watched the boats on the river.
China? He sighed. Who would name a child China?
And that was China Brown by Gerald Weisnor. Now we will read Basenti by Anna Lee Walters. Things weren't right. Maya sat on the mattress and sank into its springs and lumps. She contemplated the squareness of the small room, sharpened by the afternoon shadows strewn across the floor. The angular walls, the floor and ceiling tiles cut impotently into infinite space and time, but the fragile structure confined her there indefinitely. She stared out the rectangular windows to an identical house across the street and closed her eyes tightly.
I have this feeling that something is wrong, Maya said sheepishly to Wilma when Wilma entered the room.
Wilma was round, and her circular shadow broke up the box space in the sparsely furnished room as Wilma gestured and moved around.
Oh, what's the matter? Wilma asked with concern.
Her eyebrows lifted in a question. Maya's oval brown face cracked slowly into a crooked smile. She asked, Did you ever look at this room, Wilma? The squareness of our little worlds? The insignificant walls? Have you ever wondered if there were a futility and senselessness in these structures? Why are we so infatuated with squares? Are there squares in the real world? Maya giggled at herself and pointed out the window with her last question. As Wilma sipped her coffee noisily, she studied Maya's face. It wore a nervous frown that was there 1 minute and gone the next.
You didn't come here to talk to me about this room, Wilma said matter-of-factly. You didn't drive all the way from Albuquerque to Santa Fe to question me about this room.
Uh-uh.
Maya put down her own mug of coffee and looked into the eyes of her old friend intently for a few seconds, making a decision to tell Wilma everything. She dropped her voice to barely a whisper. Wilma had to lean toward Maya to catch the words Maya let go. The words visibly hung in the air between the two women for seconds. Maya said, Things have been happening to me lately. I've lost some things.
Well, actually, they were taken, you know. Stolen.
Maya watched Wilma's response. Wilma's face was blank. Maya continued,
Then, there have been accidents on the highway, traffic accidents, all occurring within seconds from me. Too close.
Wilma was sipping coffee. Her shadow slipped under her and stayed a step ahead of her as she glided to a chair, one of three pieces of furniture in the room. Maya bent and leaned even closer to Wilma. The wooden chair holding Maya's weight made a little sound. Planes of light and shadow played over Maya's face as she asked Wilma, Do you know what I am talking about? The frown was laying over Maya's face again. Wilma nodded her head decisively.
Yeah, oh sure. I was just thinking about things you can do about it. First, tell me about the things you've lost. Did you get anything back? Returned to you?
Maya leaned forward and held her oval face in her long fingers.
Her pointed elbows were on her knees. Well, first, two blankets disappeared. That pretty purple one with the tan and black stripes. Then I missed a red one with green fringes, both taken from the place I'm now staying in Albuquerque. Go on, Wilma encouraged. Maya looked thoughtful and far away. Maya's round figure stood before the rectangular window. Clouds floated on her shoulders and through her black hair. A purse was taken next. Everything in it, Maya said. She waved her purse away with a soft, bare arm. A streak of sunlight radiated under her arm. And the accidents? Wilma prodded. Always to other people, just ahead or just behind me. A split second from me, as far as you are to me. It's happened 3 times now. People died each time. Maya poured the remaining coffee into her mouth and sat back on the chair. The room was quiet. The sunlight on the floor crawled from Wilma's feet to Maya's, halfway across the room. Maya's face went through a variety of expressions in the silence, while Wilma's face stayed blank, noncommittal. Then Wilma soothed Maya's prolonged frown. Stay here tonight. You can, can't you? We'll talk and think this thing through, okay? Maya nodded her head, though she did not speak. She went again to the window, staring beyond the house across the street, into infinite space and time. If we can't come up with any answers or solutions, then you go to Bacenti. You ought to, anyway, to find out about your missing things. He'll locate them for you, okay? Wilma asked, while Maya nodded her head again. Their shadows had stretched longer by then, and the planes of the room were elongated, distorted by the hour at hand. The Sangre de Cristo mountains loomed in the east, soft and rolling cones, under a melting orange and purple sky. This evening was cool. A gentle wind from the south played on the two women. Maya and Wilma sat on the porch. Wilma hummed a tribal song as the two watched the mountains, and the sky and clouds dissolved into darkness. Maya said, Wilma, you've been listening to my problems all day. I didn't even ask you about the vandalism you have been experiencing out here. What's happening? Wilma answered, Well, we're about 10 miles from town. I guess distance may have something to do with it. But things have been quiet lately. If you don't count the weird incident that happened next door. She raised a finger and indicated her nearest neighbor's house. Then she continued, It happened about a month ago. And Maya, you can't really call it vandalism. All that can be said about it is that it was very strange. Bizarre might be the word to describe it. That reminds me, Maya, you ought to park your car up here by the house. Well, anyway, she went back to her story. This lady and her husband next door, they're Spanish people. One evening they come home and park their car out in the parking lot in front of the house. See? The next morning, the car was upside down. It was pretty strange. No one heard a sound during the night. But sure enough, the next morning, there was this car sitting in the exact spot where it had been parked the evening before. But it was upside down. Maya laughed. I guess so. I hope things like that don't happen too often. Are you afraid of living out here by yourself? Not at all, Wilma chuckled. I usually enjoy it. I can't stand the thought of living cooped up in town. The houses are so close together. We're close here, too, but it's different. Besides, Raul is here more often than not. Maya, you haven't met him, but you'll like him, Maya, when you do meet him. He's mostly Spanish, but he's part Indian, too. Is everyone here Spanish? Maya wanted to know. Mixed, but mostly Spanish. There's a Taos family on the other side, an old Comanche woman down this street, and then there are Diné, Navajos. She laughed. The rest are Bilagana or Nakai. As an afterthought, Wilma said, Indians are everywhere, no matter where you go. Maya smiled. It's a nice, peaceful community, she said.
Too bad about the vandalism. As often as I've been here, I would never have known the problem exists out here if you hadn't told me.
The two women sat there for a while longer until Wilma asked Maya if she were tired. Maya admitted that she was. Stress had taken its toll. Before they retired, Wilma said, "Maya, why don't you move your car up here, beside the porch?" Maya said, "Nothing's ever happened before. I'm sure it'll be okay. I'll just leave it where it is." Maya stretched out on top of a sleeping bag in the middle of Wilma's square floor. Her eyelids soon twitched in a deep sleep. Wilma stood over her friend for a long time that night, thinking of the words Maya had dropped in the next room. A frown creased Wilma's forehead now that Maya couldn't see. Wilma went to the only window in this room to close the drapes. She raised the window several inches to allow a breeze to circulate. She saw Maya's car sitting under a street lamp that emitted a yellow circle of light around the car. About midnight, Maya awoke. Her eyes stared into the blackness of the square room. She was fully conscious. Her thoughts went immediately to her car. "They're doing something to it," she whispered. She rose, went to the window, and looked out. The car sat safely under the high beam of the street lamp. Maya breathed a sigh of relief. She sat in the rocking chair beside the window and kept a vigil over her car for a few minutes. Then, satisfied for the moment that it was safe, she lay back inside the sleeping bag. The breeze was stronger, billowing in the drapes. At 5:30 the next morning, the alarm buzzed. The Sangre de Cristo Mountains were a faint shape outside Wilma's house. A white line curved around the horizon of the mountains. Sun streaks spread fan-like at one end of the range. Wilma got out of bed and stopped the buzzing alarm. The house was all dark. She walked from her room to the one where Maya slept. She pulled the cord at the window. The drapes, like stage curtains, parted on the glowing horizon. A cold wave slid into the room. The window was still open. Outside in the parking lot, the street lamps were dark. Wilma could see the faint blue mountains in the east. The silhouette of night in the west engulfed nearby homes. Wilma went to the kitchen to put coffee in the percolator. She turned on the radio. Its dials were fluorescent when Wilma flipped off the light switch. Then she went into the bedroom, stripped off her clothes, and went naked into the bathroom. In a few minutes, the shower could be heard. Maya woke to a country and western singer moaning on the radio and the shower beating into the bathtub. She lay there a moment with her eyes closed, listening to the music drift into the room. The odor of perking coffee followed the music. When Wilma entered the room in a long white terry cloth robe, Maya asked, "What time is it? I have to be in Albuquerque by 8. I have one of those awful early morning classes today." "It's about 5:45, Wilma answered, drying her long hair with a red towel. "I set the alarm a half hour early so we can visit a little longer. I have to go to work, too. I hope you don't mind my getting you up so early." "Oh, no, I'm glad you did," Maya said. She sat on the sleeping bag and added, "Wilma, thank you for everything. I feel much better, refreshed, and in a clean frame of mind. I'll go to Bacenti this weekend." "Good. I'm glad that's settled," Wilma answered, shaking out her long, wet hair that had fallen to her waist. She said, "Maya, I think the coffee's ready. You want some?" But Maya held up a hand and said, "I'll jump in the shower first." She gathered her clothes and carried a small suitcase into the bathroom. The light in there escaped from under the closed door. The rest of the house was dark. Wilma went to lower the open window in the room. Her wet hair had chilled her. While she was pulling the window down, she looked toward Maya's car. It was assuming a vague shape in the dawn. Wilma paused momentarily, straining her eyes at the car. She said, and went into the kitchen. She poured a cup of coffee and looked at the radio when the female announcer came on and said in a seductive voice,
Good morning, sleepyhead. It's 6 a.m.
Not too long after, Maya padded into the room. Her hair was wrapped in a towel, turban style. She wore blue jeans and a turquoise blouse. Her toes stuck out of her house shoes. She poured herself a cup of coffee and took a taste. That's when Wilma said,
Maya, it looks like there is something on your car.
Oh, was Maya's response. Her feet padded to the open window. The sun had not risen yet, but the mountains were purple and the sky above them was a delicate pink. Daylight was spreading tentatively toward Wilma's community. The community buildings, however, were still square silhouettes against the fingers of dawn. It's a beautiful morning, was Maya's first observation. Then her eyes went to the car. There was something on it, but she was nearsighted and without her glasses. She said,
Yes, Wilma, there does seem to be something on it, but I can't make it out that well.
Her words made her remember the vigil at midnight. Wilma stood at Maya's side. She said,
Let's go see. Maybe they punctured your tires or something like that.
The two women walked out of the house. Maya carried her mug of coffee. They stood on the porch. Wilma pointed to her flower bed. The flowers were uncurling. They walked past the marigolds and down to the parking lot. None of the other houses were lit, not even the apartment complex at the end of the block. The local streets were empty of early morning traffic.
That's strange, Maya said. There doesn't seem to be anyone stirring but us.
Wilma looked up and down the streets. Her damp hair clung to her shoulders.
Yeah, that's right, isn't it?
She agreed with Maya. The dome sky was turning a pale blue. Clouds skirted the mountaintops. Maya's car pointed north. As she walked toward it, she noted that the windows were unbroken, the tires inflated. The car appeared to be unharmed, at least on one side. But what was that on top of it? A black shadow lay on the roof of the car. It stretched the entire length of the roof. Maya and Wilma stopped about 10 feet from the car. Their eyes locked briefly. Then both women had the same thought. They gazed at the houses around them. The houses were mute and lifeless forms. Wilma pulled her wet hair over her right shoulder and looked southwest. The Sandia Mountains were now distinguishable in the dawn. A crescent moon glittered on Sandia Peak. A few cars on Interstate 40 still had their lights on. These lights zipped east and west without a sound.
Strange, commented Wilma.
Maya took a shaky step closer to the shadow on her car. Wilma followed, and when Maya stopped just at the left headlight, Wilma did too.
What in the world?
Wilma asked in a breathy and perplexed voice. Maya was frozen for a second, desperately sorting images that flashed before her eyes. She saw herself standing in front of the car, moving like an actress in a bizarre play, detached from herself, but nevertheless affected. The only thing she could say was,
What?
And again,
What?
The thing on the car grew into a foreboding shape in morning light. A large dog was draped over the roof of the car. The outline of its head was clearly discernible.
What?
Maya repeated.
How?
She didn't finish the question. The animal did not move. Maya half expected it to pounce on her or off the car. Again, Maya's eyes zeroed in on the houses. Not a curtain in any window fluttered. She noted that Wilma, too, was studying the houses. When the dog did not move, Maya put her coffee mug on the hood of the car and took another step. It was then that she saw the spray of blood covering the front window on the passenger side. It had dripped down the side windows on the other side of the car. Dried pools of red stained the cement. The jaws of the dog hung open, and it looked as if this was from where the blood had gushed until the animal was thoroughly drained. Maya tried to make sense of the scene. She went through a flood of emotion, anger, compassion for the dead animal, and resolution not to submit to fear. "Let's go inside," she told Wilma. Wilma nodded, grabbed the mug she had placed on the hood, and involuntarily shivered. Inside the house, Maya grabbed Wilma by the shoulders and asked, "What's happening?" Wilma's eyes were round and her mouth was round too as she said, "Oh, Maya, I don't know. It's like that incident with the car. Weird as hell. What shall we do?"
"I don't know," Maya said. "Let me think."
She kicked off her house shoes and slipped on leather sandals. While she did this, Wilma threw on the clothes she had worn the day before. "We have to get rid of it," Maya said. "Someone gave that thing to me. I don't want it. I refuse it. I'm taking it back to wherever it came from." "We'll have to clean the car," Wilma said. She ran to get a plastic jar of dish detergent, and she filled a Tupperware bowl with warm water.
"I don't get it," Maya said, looking out the window once more. "Where is everyone? There used to be early morning traffic here. I remember that."
"Don't try to figure it out now, Maya. Let's act. Move. Do something," Wilma said. "The absence of the neighbors? Maybe we can use it to our advantage."
"Yeah, okay."
Maya nodded her head. She took a roll of paper towels Wilma handed to her. Again, they ventured out. The sky was opaque. The sun had not yet climbed the lowest mountains. Not one car passed on this street or down the side streets. Maya and Wilma acted quickly and in coordination. The two women lifted the dead animal off the roof of the car. Its body was stiff and heavy. It must have weighed a good 70 pounds. They laid the rigid body just off the walkway in front of Maya's car. Again, anger filled Maya as she poured soapy water on the dried blood. Wilma scrubbed the front of the car while Maya did the side, wiping the car clean and dry with paper towels. It took a few minutes. Wilma went back inside the house. Maya stayed to empty the remaining water on the pools of blood on the cement. The soapy water colored a pink tint and ran in rivulets down the street. Then Maya noticed something she hadn't seen before. A trail of blood led to her car from across the street. She followed it and came upon another pool of blood just in front of the house opposite Wilma's house. From there, the trail went down the block. Maya stood in front of that house for a moment. Then she quickly walked to the place where she and Wilma had carefully laid the animal, a few feet from the car. She picked up the stiffened body by its front and back legs, and she carried it across the street, struggling with her burden and panting when she was done. She left the dog in the pool of dried blood there, stood defiantly and challengingly in front of that house. There were no signs of life in the neighborhood yet. She scooped up a handful of dirt from that yard and carried it to her car, where she scattered it over the drying pools of water and blood. She rubbed the dirt over the cement viciously with her sandals. The blood darkened to brown spots.
"Now," Maya whispered, "we'll see what happens."
At that moment, a light came on in a house on a corner. She heard a door slam somewhere. A quick look inside her car reassured her that nothing more had been done to it. The tires were in good shape. She retraced her steps to Wilma's house. Wilma met her at the door. Wilma's wet hair was tied with rubber band and she wore a sweater.
"What now?" Wilma wanted to know.
"We wait and see what happens," Maya said. "No matter what does happen, though, we don't know anything about that dog, okay?"
"It's the best way," Wilma said.
Maya unwrapped the towel around her head.
"What time is it?" she asked.
"It's about 6:40, Wilma said. "You should leave before 7 if you want to make that class."
Maya asked, "Will you be all right?"
Wilma went into the kitchen, searching for the coffee cup she'd put down someplace earlier. As she poured a hot cupful of coffee, she answered,
"I'll go to work."
"No, maybe I won't. I have time I need to use for my leave anyway. But I'll be all right." Footsteps were coming down the sidewalk outside. Wilma came out of the kitchen and looked questioningly at Maya. The steps ended on her front porch. Someone pounded on the door. Wilma opened it. Maya sat in the living room and listened.
"What did you do with the dog?"
a female voice asked in a huff. Maya heard Wilma ask innocently, "What dog?" The woman repeated the question. Wilma asked again, "What dog? What are you talking about?" To this, the woman shrieked, "You're going to pay, killers!" Wilma then said, "Look, lady, calm down. If I can help you in some way..." But the woman interrupted the offer of help, threatening Wilma with curses and vile names. Maya heard Wilma close the door. Wilma returned to Maya. She looked calm, but Maya saw her hands shaking. "Did she frighten you? Who was she?" Maya asked. "I don't know," Wilma said, "but it wasn't the woman who scared me. It was the man."
"The man?"
Maya asked in surprise.
"Yes," Wilma said. "There was a man with her, standing behind her the whole time. He stood there in silence and made obscene gestures at me. His gyrations were so unnatural, not humanly possible. It scared the hell out of me."
"You didn't show it, did you?" Maya asked in alarm. "Fear won't help us, Wilma."
"No, I don't think it showed. I was just so startled. But it was the damnedest thing."
Wilma gripped her coffee. Maya put an arm around her friend.
"Are you okay?" Maya asked.
Wilma shuddered, but managed to smile.
"Listen, I'm going to have to leave. I hate to just walk away like this."
"I don't understand any of this," Maya said.
"It may be that walking away is the only way to respond," Wilma said, pursing her lips. "But I am convinced that you need to see Vicente, now more than ever."
Maya nodded in complete agreement.
Footsteps were at the door again. Wilma looked at Maya and went to the door.
"Killers!" the woman was screaming. "The state police are coming after you!"
Maya saw her lift a pudgy finger and stick it in Wilma's face. The woman was clownish in appearance, her face painted in brilliant hues. Maya stood behind Wilma. There was a man with the woman. He was dark, possibly Hispanic or Indian. He bobbed up and down as if there were springs in his legs and feet. He waved his arms, imitating a grounded bird, and he contorted his face into grotesque masks that changed and flitted away as quickly as they settled over his features. Then his hands went to the crotch of his pants, and he mimed an unearthly performance, contorting his body beyond the bounds of human ability. The woman with him blocking the doorway was unconcerned with his antics. She continued to shout obscenities at Wilma. They poured out in a torrent of stinging words. Then Maya said to the woman, slowly and very clearly, "I don't know what's happening or who you are, but you are not welcome here, and neither is anything that you bring with you." The words hung in the doorway for seconds. The woman's eyes blinked in surprise at Maya's words. For a moment, the woman's own stream of words stopped. She balanced her bulky weight on one foot. Her painted face became a frozen mask. The dark man behind the woman ceased his gyrations for a split second, fracturing time and space after Maya spoke. He poised himself in the interlude, unnaturally immobile. The feat was startling. Maya was elated, felt a jab of tiny victory that her words had somehow paused his weird pantomime. "Close the door," Maya said in Wilma's ear.
Wilma pushed the door shut on the two figures. Outside, the woman again started her harangue, and then the din subsided. There were no sounds of departing footsteps, only abrupt silence. Wilma went to the window to observe the walkways and parking lot.
"Nothing," she said in a low voice to Maya. "Nothing."
They gathered up Maya's things and prepared to go to Maya's car. Maya took out her keys from her pants pocket. They were ready to face whatever waited outside. Before Maya opened the door, she said to Wilma,
Wait until I see if the car is going to start. Don't leave me until I know for sure. Then I'll wait until you're back inside before I drive away. The streets were silent. None of the occupants of the dozen houses around them were visible. Wilma and Maya were completely alone. The orange rim of the sun was spreading up behind the mountains then.
I'm sorry to have to leave like this, Wilma said. But don't worry about me. I'll let Raul take me to someone like Vicente and learn something about this mess. It'll be all right. Now you just promise me that you'll see Vicente as soon as possible. Promise.
Maya nodded again and looked back toward Wilma's house. That dark man who had been on Wilma's porch a few minutes earlier now stood on the walk. Maya's head went up sharply, and she sucked in a deep breath. Wilma turned to see what had affected Maya this way. The man seemed suspended there on a background of cumulus clouds. He was detached from the earth and everything that Wilma and Maya knew. He began to bob, spring up and down, a jumping jack. Again, his hands went to his pants crotch and Maya turned away. So did Wilma.
Is it possible that I'm cracking up? Maya asked Wilma.
Wilma smiled a caring and trusting smile.
If you are, I am too, she told Maya. Look, Maya, don't mention this. What's happened here to anyone? You know what I mean. Other than the likes of Vicente, few people understand, have seen beyond.
Maya looked again to where the dark man had been. He disappeared into Santa Fe's thin air.
Yeah, Maya said. I know. I agree. Our people understand. This kind of fracture of space and time. But like you say, there's only a few who do. Don't worry. I won't say anything. Now you go inside as soon as the car starts.
She unlocked the car, took her glasses from the glove compartment, and put the key in the ignition. The car started smoothly.
Okay, Maya said to Wilma. Go on. I'll wait until you get inside.
Wilma reached inside the car and hugged Maya. Then she turned and retreated to the house. Maya backed out of the parking lot slowly, noting that the curtains in a few houses were moving. She turned on the radio and set the dial on the Santa Fe station. The woman's voice had not abandoned the seductive tone, and it was now 7:05. Wilma waited alone in her house all day, expecting something to happen, but nothing did. About mid-morning, the neighbors showed some signs of life and activity. Cars cruised the streets. Maya drove directly to Albuquerque, negotiating the tricky freeway traffic in time to make her 8:15 class at the university. But her mind played a reel of events that had happened to her recently. Broken images of the dawning hours returned to her. By then, she was doubting her senses, asking herself if any of it had really happened. In a university parking lot, she climbed out of her car, ambivalent about what she should do. She gathered her books from the car trunk and slammed it down hard. Splotches of dried red blood on the car caught her eye. Suddenly, her doubts vanished. Her mind cleared. She set her jaw in determination, and she climbed back into the car. Vicente was in Arizona, 6 hours away. It was nearly 4 when Maya arrived home. Her family met her at the door.
What's wrong, Mom? One of her children asked. You're not supposed to be home yet. Are you cutting class?
The boy laughed, and then he noticed Maya's strained face. He asked, Are you all right? No, Maya answered. Let's talk. In Santa Fe, Raul knocked on Wilma's door. Wilma let him in. He hugged her, his white even teeth showing in a wide smile.
How's my girl today? He asked.
Wilma answered him,
Raul, how would you like to take me for a long ride today?
How long? Raul questioned.
To Canyoncito, 30 miles from Albuquerque, Wilma told him. I'll make it worth your while, she said with a wink.
Okay by me, but why are we going to Canyoncito? Raul inquired.
I have to see a man there, Wilma said.
Raoul smiled and teased.
Won't I do?
Wilma laughed.
Afraid not, lover boy. The man we're going to see finds things, tells you what's wrong. Know what I mean?
Raoul nodded. He understood. At dusk, Maya and her man were riding down a treacherous road that wound through sagebrush and pinyon trees. The Chuska Mountains were dark green behind them, and Black Mesa was ahead of them some 40 miles distant. A cribbed log hogan and a house were in sight at the end of the road. Sheep were penned in a nearby corral, and their bleating sailed through the evening space and time. Maya's man went into the house, and not long after came to get Maya, waiting in the pickup truck.
Vicente is in the hogan, he said.
He opened the truck door. Maya followed him inside the dark hogan. Maya's man greeted Vicente, who sat on a sheepskin that covered the earth and ground. They touched each other's hands, then Maya touched Vicente's hand and took a place on the sheepskin beside him. Through the smoke hole, Maya watched the pink sky fade. In time, Maya told him everything. Things weren't right, she said intermittently, while he sat and listened, not surprised at anything she said. They left Vicente's hogan over an hour later. The eastern sky was sprinkled with early stars, and the world appeared as it should be. Vicente would come to Maya's house the next night. He would quietly tell all. Then he would bind the tiniest fracture in infinite space and time. Then he would go silently away until the next time. And that was Vicente by Anna Lee Walters. Thank you for joining us as we've read Western short stories from Talking Leaves, Contemporary Native American Short Stories. This has been Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
An old cowpoke went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plowing through the ragged sky, and up the cloudy draw.
If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org, left click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then, under Programming Links, left click on On-Demand Podcasts. You can also now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.